thanks to Misoma for sponsoring the first series of The Making Of. Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Misoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative, and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Misoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Misoma.com. You're listening to The Making Of, a brand new podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. We talk about the highs and the lows and the turning points that have shaped their lives, but don't worry, I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest this week is the journalist, author, and absolute legend, Catlin Moran.
My ideal would be that all these women that we revere for being naturally beautiful would finally be able to say in interviews, yeah, I look this great because I take some Botox, it's not an issue.
Catlin is a columnist for The Times and author of many books, including the iconic feminist Bible, How to Be a Woman. If you're familiar with her work, then you'll know that very few subjects are off limits. So our conversation was a bit risque at times, might not be one to listen to with small children. We covered Botox, mental health, talking to yourself like a dog, and marrying the right person. We talked over Zoom on the busy launch day of her new book, More Than a Woman, which is where our conversation begins. So here we go. Now, it is an exciting day because it is, of course, launch day of your book, More Than a Woman. I won't sing it because of legal reasons, but love the title.
Well, I can't deny it's been a weird day. So there are 600 other books coming out today. It's the most amount of books that have ever been published because of the corona backlog. And the day started with me being interviewed by Lorraine Kelly at 8:30 in the morning, who ended our interview. We got on very well. And she ended the interview shouting, "I'm going to reclaim the word vulva," which was already amazing. Lorraine Kelly shouting vulva at 8:30 in the morning. I didn't think that was legally allowable. But then I saw that the subtitles had thought that she was shouting, "I'm going to reclaim the word Volvo." So now there's so many hard of hearing and deaf people in the country who are like, what? Was Volvo's secret? Is Lorraine busting some kind of sanctions here? What's going on? So that's
what
very
was
much
so bad about a Volvo?
I know, right? I've been saying Volvo all my life. Was that problematic? So yeah, so the day that set the tone for the rest of the day.
Now, in this horrible period, you've had a book out and the movie How to Build a Girl come out. You've missed out on two major parties. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, my liver is grateful, but my soul is sad.
Now, before we talk about your new book, I just want to talk a bit about your old book, How to Be a Woman. Do you fully appreciate how much that really changed the face of mainstream feminism?
I mean, there were moments where you're kind of like, okay, this is having a big impact. Like my favourite one being when I was on a train and a group of about 10, 14-year-old girls came running towards me and they went, "Are you Catlin Moran? Did you write How to Be a Woman? We read about masturbation in there and it sounded brilliant. So we started doing it." That was obviously amazing. But then I looked down and my children, who were 10 and 8 at the time, were just staring up at me like, "Mummy, this isn't nice." And I had to get off the train and then explain to them what masturbation was. It was a conversation we needed to have at some point, and it was the best possible prompt for it. It was sold very effectively as a good thing by those girls.
That shows the impact. But honestly, like among my friends, I remember before that book came out, very intelligent women were saying that they weren't feminists.
Yes.
And they were like, "Well, I don't know if I'm a feminist. I'm, you know, a humanist." And you really changed, you created that whole sort of phrase of, if you like equality, you're a feminist.
Yes.
It's just deal with it.
I mean, I didn't really know that much about feminism. I was just an instinctive common sense feminist. So I'd never read any of the bib books or any of the academic stuff. And I was just really aware when I was writing the book, the reason that I wrote it is that people just weren't using the word feminist anymore. It had become very siloed, very serious, very academic. And we need all the serious academic stuff. That's great. But like someone needed to just write something that was funny and accessible, that instead of being like, "You should be into feminism, it'd be good for your soul," that just went, "Feminism is joy and fun and freedom. Let me tell you why you are a feminist. Like, because unless you are a woman who hasn't had an education, you know, is owned by either her father or her husband, like kind of is giving her paycheck to her husband. You know, this is what our lives were like 100 years ago. We don't live those lives anymore. We can vote, we can smoke, you know, we can use contraception, we can talk about sex. We lead feminist lives. But for some reason, women didn't know that they were feminists. And I was like, I think I can explain it to people and make it funny. And it worked. My two favourite pictures from that time, there's one, a friend of mine got onto the tube about a week after it came out and took a picture of the carriage. And of like the 50 people who were in the carriage, 30 of them were reading it, which was like, oh my God. And then my and then my favourite one, The Sun published a picture of Kate Moss naked on a beach. She had a fag on, she'd got a glass of champagne, and she was holly naked and reading How to Be a Woman. And I was like, well, that's the publicity campaign in a nutshell. That's good.
That is so good. That's amazing. But you wrote recently about how you go back to that book and now think you got a lot of stuff wrong.
Well, in the way that, yeah, not in a kind of recanting everything, but just in the way that you do when you get older. And also the conversation's changed a lot. You know, I was, you know, my rants about high heels aren't as needed now because you can get really lovely flat shoes and people wear them to awards ceremonies. So, like, you know, a lot of stuff has changed. One of the main things I thought I got wrong was Botox. And that's been one of the most controversial things that I've written about. I've written about, you know, my abortions and masturbation and all these things. But there are some feminists who are angry that I've said, oh, you know, I use Botox, let's talk about it. And the reason I wanted to write about it is because it's so controversial. Because there are...
Was that noise your dog?
It is, yeah. Sorry, it's digging at the carpet because it's stupid. Luna, nothing will happen if you dig the carpet. Sorry, yeah, it's just a very stupid dog. I apologise to everybody.
I'm just declaring what that noise is in case everyone thought you were just like, I don't know.
Masturbating.
I mean, it's
quite a scratchy sound. So it's because I'm in the industry and I meet famous people and stuff, I knew that all these women, and I wish I could name names, but it would be unkind and incorrect. All the women that we go, they have aged so gracefully. They are beautiful. It proves that you can look so brilliant and natural and beautiful when you're in your 50s and 60s and, you know, in your 40s and stuff. And I would talk to women in the beauty industry and they would go, no, they all have Botox, but they can't admit it. They all have to say, no, I just wash my face with a cleanser and then it's just a slick of Vaseline on the lips. Is it balls? Basically, if you're looking at someone who looks really amazing, who's your age and older, and you're going, there's no way I could look like that naturally. What is going on? Am I a gnome? It's not that you're a gnome. It's just that they are using very carefully applied small amounts of Botox and you aren't. And I just wanted to be truthful about that. I'm not selling it to anybody. Like, if you don't want to do it, do it. But like, I know so many women who really want to have it, but think that they wouldn't be good feminists. And it's like, what is the difference between, like, you know, going and having a facial or using these serums or eating all these supplements and getting a really safe injection that lasts for 6 months and is incredibly effective and stops you, as I looked before, like a sad deflated Gruffalo?
Well, if that isn't an ad for Botox, no longer sad, deflated Gruffalo.
No, cheerful. That was the other thing. Like, you know, I am generally really happy and optimistic, but my face, like, kind of like, I just constantly look slightly traumatized, and that isn't how I feel. And I could look happy again, but it would take so much effort that I was exhausted. And it's like, well, how is this being feminist, like exhausting myself trying to look cheerful when I could just do this thing and I would look how I feel? Like, kind of, I can't. I'm just sort of generally like, you know, if there's a low effort thing that's effective, I like that. Thank you, technology.
Well, all you have to do is lie there, right?
Right, exactly. It's over and done in like 30 seconds. Like, kind of, it's the least amount of small talk you'll ever have to make in your life.
Right. I'm just going to take a moment to talk to you a bit about Botox, who sponsor this podcast.
It's a really great method.
But I would
confirm. It's a really great way to preserve your youth.
But I would confirm, if you don't want to do it, absolutely don't do it. I'm not going around going, everyone who doesn't do Botox will look ugly and I hate them and they are stupid. It's just, I literally want you to stop feeling guilty if you want to have it. And I would also, my ideal would be that all these women that we revere for being naturally beautiful would finally be able to say in interviews, yeah, I look this great because I take some Botox. It's not an issue.
Well, I would like a lot of honesty about all of that stuff. Like, I eat whatever I like. like. I mean, you don't. If what you just like is kale, then maybe you do, but come off it.
My favourite one is when they go, how did you lose the baby weight? And they said, oh, well, just from running around after the children. Like, children can't move that far. Like, you know, you're not going to do a 26-mile aerobic high-intensity workout chasing a toddler. It's going to go to the kitchen and then you'll stop it. Like, there is no way you've dropped 3 stone from just running around after the kids. It's bald.
Totally. That is absolute balls. So let's go to the 6 moments that have made you, chosen by you. Number one, age 13, and believing that you had inadvertently shopped your parents to the DHSS and that you would lose your benefits. So, first of all, before we get into that, a little bit of background in case anybody doesn't know. You grew up in Wolverhampton. You were the oldest of 8 siblings. In a 3-bedroom house.
Yes.
Your father was on sickness?
Yes, he was disabled. And my mother was on a carer's allowance. So we were on benefits and, you know, we were poor and it was precarious. And it was at a time when they were always talking about axing benefits or reducing them anyway. And my dad had always told me not to talk about the fact that he was disabled. He wanted everyone to pretend that he had a job. First of all, for his own dignity. And secondly, because even though he has really bad osteoarthritis, as anybody who knows who's got osteoarthritis, you have good days and bad days. On the bad days, he'd be flat on his back, off his face on painkillers. On the days that were good, because he was poor, he would have to like go and mend the car because we couldn't take it to a garage. So he was like, if someone knows I'm on benefits and that I'm disabled, but they see me dropping the clutch out of a car on the drive, they will shop us to the DHS and we will be ruined. We will go to the poorhouse. So it was that was the background. It was like, you must never tell anyone you're on benefits because that we might lose them. And I befriended an old lady who lived down the road because she'd had kittens and she was playing with the kittens in the garden. And I was like, I would like to be part of this kitten world. Let me into your kitten life. And we chatted and she had biscuits and I liked the biscuits and the biscuits loosened my tongue. I was drunk on sugar and carbohydrates. And at some point I mentioned that my dad was on benefits. And then I looked to the side and I saw there was a copy of the Daily Mail in her house. And my understanding was that if you were Daily Mail, you were right wing and you would immediately shop me to the DSS. So I was terrified. And so I started to write. I was like, I will have to start earning money so that if they take the benefits away, I can support the family. And so that was why I started writing, because I was absolutely terrified. I was full of a dose of life-changing adrenaline. If you are that scared and that riddled with cortisol, suddenly you become ambitious and hardworking because you're so terrified you'll just do anything and stay up late to try and make the anxious feeling go away. So that was why I started writing, because I was scared.
That is an amazing story. And you were scared and needed the money, right? So it's not like, hey, I wanted to like fulfill my creative potential. You're like, how can I get money?
No, bitch got to pay rent. And I knew from reading books that that was the only way that you could earn money if you were poor. Like, I couldn't get a job anywhere else. I was 13. And like, you know, that's what Joe does in Little Women. That's what the mum does in The Railway Children. Like, that is the sort of the option that is open to you if you are poor and you have no facilities. So that was why I started writing, to try and earn some money. So I started writing a book. That took 3 years to write. I was very scared all the way through that process. Like, whenever the post would come, I thought the DSS might send us a letter saying they'd taken away the benefits. So whenever the post came every morning, I'd run to the letterbox and like look through the letters in case there was one that looked like it was from them. And I hadn't really worked out the next bit of the plan. I don't know if I would have just torn it up or like, I don't know. That was as far as that plan had got.
Gosh, that's so sad though, to live in that kind of fear. How long did that go on for? When did you sort of think, okay, it's not going to happen?
I sent the book when it was finished to loads and loads of publishers. And when I finally got a deal, there was a morning where I woke up and I knew they were going to call me and offer me the deal officially. So I was like, okay, my terror will end today. Today's the day they tell me about how much money I'm going to get. And so everything will be all right. And I've solved this problem. Well done, me. And I had no idea how much you got paid to write books, but I figured maybe it was £1 million. And that would be enough to support my family for the rest of their lives. And then when they rang me up and offered me the deal, it was £1,100. And that was for 3 years' work. And I could see that probably wasn't going to sustain me and my family. So when the book came out, I was interviewed by quite a few people because it was like, wow, a child's written a book. And one of them was the columnist at the Times, Valerie Grove. And I just asked her after the interview finished, I was like, Valerie, how do you actually make money being a writer? Because you clearly don't earn it off writing books. And she said, be a journalist, babe, but be a columnist. If you write something every week, you'll get paid. So I was like, right, I will become a journalist then. So then I started writing columns and sending them off to newspapers. And I sent one to the Times. I faxed it to them from the newsagents around the corner. And by the time I got home, they'd called the house and went, we'll give you a column. and I was 17.
Wow.
And now, wow. It genuinely took me 20 years to realise that's not usually how people get a column on a broadsheet newspaper. That was fairly extraordinary. So well done, me.
Well done, you. I mean, that's amazing. Now, you were homeschooled.
Mm.
Do you think that the kind of incredibly advanced sort of career beginning that you had was to do with that, like, because you weren't sort of seeing what your peers were doing? And
yes, the homeschooling is absolutely fascinating. So I think in terms of your education, it's better to be homeschooled, because so much of what is happening in a school is basically crowd management. And so when my daughter was really ill and she was off school for 6 months, she had a tutor for 3 hours a week just to keep up with her schoolwork. And when she got back, she was almost a year ahead of everyone else in the school just from 3 hours wow. a week, because that is, you're doing so little actual learning at school. And of course, the other thing that schooling, formal schooling does, is that because you're being told to do all this stuff, a good proportion of which you'll hate and have no interest in, A, it makes you feel like a bit of a failure that you're not naturally great at maths, and B, it crushes your natural curiosity. The last thing you would want to do is learn something more if you've been at school all week. Whereas once you come out of school, after a couple of weeks of like mucking about and thinking it's a holiday, a child's natural curiosity comes back. Kids want to learn. The young of every species wants to learn. Mm. So within a couple of months, you watch kids, and it happens time and time again. They go off and they get obsessed with science or making rockets or like writing or art or whatever. And you never need to tell a homeschool child to do some homework, because they are just doing the thing that they love. So it makes you very self-disciplined. It makes you really concentrate on what you want. You don't feel like a failure. It's amazing for your psyche. It's amazing if you want to be a creative artist. The thing it's bad for is socialising. Obviously, because you're not seeing anyone.
Now, let me just go into your second moment, because this is connected in a way, because this is kind of, I feel, about self-assuredness, which maybe came from your home schooling, which is moment number two. Age 15, you get a letter from Lenny Henry after you applied for the job of managing director of Comic Relief. What happened?
Yeah, I was like, well, you know, what's the worst that can happen? So it was after I'd finished the book, but before I'd been offered a deal, and I was thinking of ways to earn money and like kind of going, what kind of job could I do? And there was an advert in the paper for a new managing director of Comic Relief. And I loved watching Comic Relief on telly. And I was like, wow, I'd get to hang out with comedians like Mel Smith and Griff Rhys-Jones. That would be fun. So I applied, and I got this really beautiful letter back on Comic Relief headed notepaper from Lenny Henry going, look, you would find this job very boring, like, but I am absolutely sure that you will fly like a comet through the skies of British society. All my love, Lenny Henry. And absolutely. That rewired my head, because I'd never, and I'm really aware of this now, like, you know, now I have some fame and some people know who I am. I do these signings at all my events that go on for hours, and I meet incredible women, and I know the power of just being able to hold them and hug them and look them in the eye and go, you're amazing. Like, kind of, you're going to do something incredible. Like, kind of, I know you're going to succeed. Like, you're amazing. You know, if you're going through a bad time now, it's going to be okay. But I see you. Here's a hug. I love you. Keep in touch with me on Twitter. Like, you're being watched now by me. And I know, particularly if you come from an unsupported background or if you've got very low self-esteem, that it literally rewires a part of your head. You will burn a new synaptic connection that goes, I have been seen by someone that I admire, and I am now seeing myself a little bit through their eyes. And it genuinely changes the way that you feel about yourself, because that is how I felt. I was like, Lenny Henry thought about me, and he seems to think I might be cool. Maybe I am. And that was not a thought I had had before. I had very low self-esteem before then, and this properly rewired my head. So I now pass on the brilliant thing that Lenny did for me to people that I meet. And I finally met him in person a couple of years ago at an opening night for something in the theatre. And I told him this story, and he gave me such a big hug. And I was just a little bit tearful. I was like, you were like the confidence daddy in my mind. You made everything so much better. Thank you so much.
Oh, that's an amazing story. And actually, I love moments like that that are like a switch or something. You know, there aren't many of them in life, but that's just so moving. And it's so true that, like, just someone like seeing you, you know, and like believing in you. Oh, that sounds cheesy, but it is actually really powerful.
Yeah, and we don't have enough of those moments. Like, you know, like even with the people that you know and love, like, you know, you'll start taking each other for granted after a bit. And then you think, God, when was the last time I actually sat you down and told you why you're brilliant? And that is what I usually do when I'm drunk, to the point where people need to remove me. I don't get angry. I don't get sexual. What I do is I sit people down and I do like a rant about why they're amazing. And with one of my friends, Sally Hughes, the journalist, who's like, who doesn't...
Oh, she's yeah, very, I know her.
Yeah, she's very cat-like. I'm very dog-like. And one night when I was much drunker than her, I held her face in my hands and sort of recited this poetry and talking about how she was as pale as a river washed bone and how she just like set hearts afire, while she looked so unhappy and uncomfortable.
That's so funny.
I literally love bombed pretty... her. I mean, it destroyed her. She was just like, mate, I like you too, but like, let's just move on.
I love friends like you. I mean, I have a few like that, and they're like, no, I'm serious, you could do anything, that kind of thing. And you're like, okay. But it is nice. It is actually really nice. So let's move on to moment number three, which is age 17, your husband, who you were working with at the time, telling you that he thought your writing was a bit off and cruel. This is when you're working together at Melody Maker. What happened? What did he say?
So we had both started at Melody Maker at the same time, and we were both in the Midlands. He's from Birmingham, I'm from Wolverhampton. So we'd already sort of bonded over that, and we were the two most junior writers there. And the culture at Melody Maker was that it was much cooler older boys who would wear leather jackets, and they were quite dark and cynical. And we had both started off as massive enthusiasts. We were just fans of music, so we wanted to be near the music and write about the music and music. And it was sort of very quickly made apparent to us by the older hands of the paper that that wasn't what music journalism was at this paper. That this paper, it was about kind of destroying a lot of bands. It was quite cruel and bullying, but justified by the fact, which, you know, there is some logic and truth in, that in those days, you know, a CD album would cost £14. And like, kind of, you know, only the very best stuff should go through so that people didn't waste their money. But it was really unpleasant. There was some really nasty things, and some bands were actively bullied. And I saw that that was the game. And as a child, as children do, I was like, okay, well, that's the game. I'll win. I'll be better than everyone else. I'll be the most horrible. And it peaked with me writing a review of the band Ned's Atomic Dustbin, where I imagined that I was at their funeral and I was the priest and I was giving the eulogy and they were dead in the ground and I was throwing earth onto their faces and explaining why they had made the world a worse place while they were still alive. And so the piece ran, and there was an editorial meeting every Tuesday, and you'd sort of at 11 o'clock and you'd get the new paper and everyone would read through it. And I was expecting everyone around the table to be like, wow, that was amazing. You really went there. You are the baddest bitch. And there was a bit of quiet. Even they were quite uncomfortable with it. And then afterwards in the hallway, my husband came up to me and just went, mate, that review was a bit off. And that's as near as he's ever got to an outright criticism of me in 25 years. But he was just like, that's not you. Like, kind of, you're an enthusiast. Like, why are you pretending to be horrible? And it blew my mind, really. And then became the basis of the plot to the film How to Build a Girl. Like, you know, that's the journey absolutely. That Beanie goes on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did that... And so did you actually change from that moment onwards?
Yes. I mean, me and my husband publicly confessed our love of Crowded House, which were not seen as an acceptable band at the magazine. And I only wrote about things that I loved, which is what I've done ever since. Like, I've been a TV critic, and the interviews that I do with, I don't know, Lady Gaga or Benedict Cumberbatch or whatever, I only ever go and review or talk about things that I love, because I think you know, whenever you're talking about a culture war or even fandom, there's just this idea that if you hate something and you think things should be better, that first of all, what you do is destroy the thing you hate or don't like or were disappointed by. And you do that online and you sign petitions and you're all really horrible about it and you troll these people. And then once the bad thing has been destroyed, then presumably a good thing would come in its place. And it's like, well, you don't need to bother with the destruction phase. You could just go straight to creating the new thing. Like, kind of like, you don't ever need to destroy anything. Just you know, give more choice. Expand the lexicon is always the best advice. And it's good for your soul. Like, you know, I've seen people's personalities change when they think they're kind of engaging in some kind of war that they might win online about something that they hate. And it's like, you'd be so much happier if you were just pointing at the things you like and enthusiasm about them. You will attract other people who love things, and you'll have lovely conversations about the things you love rather than bonding with a group of sour people engaging in this weird one-upmanship of being the most horrible about something, which probably at the end of the day you don't hate as much as you think you do. Like, would you actually shoot them in the head because you thought that was a disappointing single? I don't think you would.
This moment when Pete, your husband, said this to you, Do you think you listened to him so much because you loved him already?
I didn't know what love was then because I was a child, and also because I was getting all my information from love from very dark, troubled records. So I was expecting and waiting for some kind of bad boy who would be really troubled that I could save, who would possibly be wearing a velvet coat and reading poetry. And so this lovely, round, womble-bodied boy in a cardigan who was just really gentle and who I felt ultimately relaxed around. I never had to drink with him. I never had to smoke when I was with him. Like, it was just, we were so happy together. And it took me a long while to realise that feeling very relaxed and comfortable, that's love, because that was not information I was being given by popular culture at the time.
But the other thing that you write about in the book, which is so brilliant and should be on a t-shirt, and I've spoken to loads of people about because you've written about it before, but it's kind of all consolidated in your book, is where you say a woman's life is only as good as the man or woman she marries. Let's talk about it.
Well, again, when you get to 45, it's like you realize that your social group has been a kind of experiment, and you're seeing how people's life decisions at, you know, teens, 20s, 30s are now impacting, you know, years down the line. So you're getting to see the evidence of like theories that you might have had or things you might have observed. Without exception, all the women that I know who are doing well in their careers and are happy and fulfilled and are succeeding and thriving are married to men who do at least 50% of the housework and childcare. And all the women I know that are struggling in their jobs or have even had to give them up were married to men who were not.
The kind of men who just go, oh, you're just better at laundry. Like, you do it. And it's like, yeah. I wasn't born better at laundry. I simply chose to read the manual. I'd gone on YouTube and learned about stains. and so there's a bit where I go, all too often a woman marries her glass ceiling. And that is sadly the case. So you have to... You've really got to look objectively at who it is you're marrying if you want to have a career and have children and not be miserable, because there's just no two ways about it.
You know, you think, oh, who I marry is a kind of nice to have or something like that, but it's actually like fundamental to how your life's going to turn out.
Yeah, you, when you're in a couple, and particularly if you're having kids and particularly if you've both got jobs, you're just in a boat together. You are each other's boats, like kind of like that. So there's nothing else. It's you two in the ocean. You're in this business deal and you are putting so much trust in the person that you marry. You've got to be so rational about it because, you know, one in three marriages end in divorce. And if you ended up giving up your job in order to look after the kids, and I understand why, childcare is the most expensive in Europe in this country. And often you're just like, well, it just doesn't make economic sense. If you get divorced, and I've got so many friends going through this, at some point you're going to be sitting in an office having to write down everything that you want that week to look after you and your child, asking your husband for like a tenner to be able to buy dog food. And you're then going to have to go and look for a flexible part-time job that can fit in around your childcare, which is the kind of job that you could have got when you were still together and the kid was young. And this is not in any way, you know, shouting at or blaming women who make these difficult choices, because it's just a shit show. It's a really badly organized system. And we have not worked out childcare in this country at all, which is one of the reasons that later in the book I suggest that, you know, we need to form a women's union. We definitely
We
need to make sure that the at least half the people in the room at any point when you're coming up with new legislation has to be women, because, you know, as we saw during the lockdown, no one was really addressing the childcare issues when they were going back to work this week and the schools were still shut, and not one single minister went, I can see it will be difficult for many of you to go back to work because no one's looking after the children. It was never addressed. That blindness is such a weakness and it screws women over.
It, absolutely, absolutely. I love the idea of the Women's Union. And that was just insane, that whole situation in lockdown. Garden centres were open and you couldn't get your children looked after. Excuse my French.
Oh, no, seriously. Oh, great. I've been so carefully not saying this. I didn't know what a language was.
Well, yes. I don't really know either what they are, but it.
Come on. It's like a Thursday afternoon.
Oh, yes. Just mum swearathon. Okay, let's go to... I'm getting hot just thinking about how annoying that is. Now, let's go to moment four.
I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I just want to take a second to tell you about The Female Lead. In case you don't know, we're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So if you haven't already, please do subscribe. It will really help us to continue our work. Now, back to the show.
Age 24, nearly dying in childbirth. Okay, hang on, I'm going to do a segue. This is like Lorraine or something. Okay. So this is moment four. Age 24, nearly dying in childbirth and realising afterwards that you had pride in the body you had previously hated. Now, I remember the story about your birth from How to Be a Woman and has always stuck in my mind. It's one of the most visceral and disturbing birth stories that I've ever read. You don't actually read that many stories about birth because who is interested in that, apart from women?
And I felt bad. So in some ways, I felt bad about writing it because I was like, that's going to scare a lot of women. And I've had a lot of women going, I decided never to have children after I read that chapter. But that's why I put the second birth, which was a good birth. And there are things you can do that will sort of help you. And I was like, I will give you this information. But that first birth was brutal. And up until that point, I had been entirely alienated from my body. Like, so both my parents were sort of disabled and ill, and so we were a very fat, unfit family who never went anywhere because we couldn't, because our parents were disabled, so we were all very overweight. And in our family, it was believed that the only thing that was important was being clever and funny and nice, so we were just heads, and right. Then from the neck down, literally didn't exist, like, kind of, that was just like ignored. And so I'd been wholly alienated from my body, and I used to have a recurring happy dream at the time where I was involved in a massive car crash and all my body got mashed up, and then the NHS rebuilt me but thin, and I would wake up from this recurring dream just going, that would be amazing and probably the only way out of this pickle. That would be the only way that I would learn to love my body. And in a way, I was involved in a horrific car crash. It was my first birth.
Right, it was the birth.
Yeah, and instead of the NHS rebuilding me but thin and that being the way that I learned to love my body, what happened was when I finally like came round, you know, back to consciousness, and I was absolutely off my face on morphine, I looked down at my body and I realised I didn't hate it anymore because it had just done something so incredible. We had gone through something together. It was going through that painful experience was the first time I'd ever been in my body and looking at it and being on its side. Like, you know, with each awful fucking contraction, I would just be looking down at my body going, mate, I'm so sorry this is happening to you. Like, I am so sorry. You know, when this finishes, you know, we're going to have a nice chat and get on with each other if we live. And when I did live, it was like, I can remember lying there breastfeeding a baby, sort of massive C-section scar, just patting my legs, kind of in wonder and going, hey, guys.
Actually, something on this subject that I noticed about the movie How to Build a Girl. So you've got Beanie Feldstein, who is playing kind of you in a way, because it's based on you. And she's obviously like a bit bigger than normal Hollywood stars. And there are a couple of references in the film to her being a bit bigger, but that doesn't really come up for her. Was that a deliberate decision that she wouldn't be self-loathing about her body in that movie?
Yes, definitely. Because I thought about that. That was one of the interesting things about doing the script. It was like, okay, well, which of my truths am I going to tell here?
Yeah. And also, like, in your book, you talk about how this is such a boring, recurring trope, women hating their bodies. And actually, why do we keep perpetuating it all the time instead of just talking about loving your body?
Totally. It's all about phases, like, you know, sort of like women being honest about how they feel about themselves, like, kind of like that's how you start with things. And, you know, the women are naturally often self-loathing and, you know, sort of like very focused on their imperfections. But I feel like we've shared that now. And it's like, OK, well, what's the next phase? It's like, so because if you don't move it on, then it's like you're going to keep hating your body, and then you'll teach your kids to hate their bodies. And all we'll ever do forever is just talk about basically that we feel disgusting as women. That's not correct. Yeah. That's not sustainable and that's not healthy. We have to find a way to love ourselves, because your body is where you live. You are never going to live anywhere else. And there's got to be a point, like, you know, you can't be at war with your body, because when you fight yourself, you'll always lose.
Yeah. Yeah. And this kind of brings us on to point five, which is quite a sad point. Which is age 40, your daughter getting ill, and you realizing that you were making it worse by being scared of her sadness. So you wrote about this a lot in your book, and it's unbelievably sad and very powerful. Can you just tell us a bit about what this moment is for you?
Yes. So she was, I mean, I think generally, and I think it's good for women to be able to say things like this, I think I'm generally a really good mum. You know, I put a lot of thought into it with a lot of effort. But the weakness that I had is that I have always been scared of sadness. So, like, you know, we just didn't discuss the sadness in our family. You'd just make a joke and move on, or, you know, you'd give yourself a treat, or you'd eat your way through it, or whatever it was. But you just, sadness was not acknowledged. It was not done. And so when my daughter started to become depressed and anxious, you know, because eating disorder is a mental illness, and it starts with depression and anxiety. And then the eating disorder is a way of coping with the anxiety and depression. So, you know, you're stacking these problems up. I was in absolute denial of it. I would just try and cheer her up out of it. I would try and like give her these TED talks, rational talks about, you know, why she should cheer up, or, you know, why she should start eating again. I would try and treat her out of it. I'd be like, you know, we'll buy you some pet rats, or we'll go on holiday. All these things, rather than do the thing that it took me 2 years to learn, which is to sit down and go, you can talk to me about how sad you are, and I will just be with you. I will just listen. I'm not going to try and make it go away. I'm not going to tell you to make it go away. We'll sit here and talk about this, or just be in silence together until it passes. And we stopped trying to sweep it under the carpet, which is what I'd done. And one of the reasons, well, I mean, the primary reason why I wrote about it in the book is because she said to me, I want you to write about this, because for my generation, her generation, there is no stigma around mental illness and eating disorders. They will discuss it. It's our generation that was brought up in an era where these things were seen as shameful or the fault of the parents. And so that disables us when we are trying to help our ill children, because we're dealing with all our horror and guilt and shame about this illness and trying to make it go away, rather than sitting down with them and going, this is just the same as if you'd broken your leg, like, kind of, this is fine. And when we published an extract about the eating disorders in the Times a couple of weeks ago, my inbox was flooded with people that I knew, people that I knew of, people that I'd never met before, going, my daughter has an eating, my son has an eating disorder, and we have never told anybody, and we keep it secret because I am so ashamed of it, and I don't know how to talk about it. And now you have written about this, I realise that that is not correct. Like, we must treat it as if our kids had leukemia, you know, or a brain tumour. You wouldn't keep that a secret. So she was like, write about it and be useful. Make sure that other parents don't make the same mistakes that you do.
I mean, I remember reading it in the Times when it came out and gave it to my husband to read. And I remember my mum texting me. She's like, have you read this piece? It was so, so powerful. But also, I think it just, I mean, no, you hadn't ever talked about it before. And then the idea that you had been dealing with this, I think for people that followed your column and stuff, you know, I think there was just a huge feeling of empathy for you and like, and just respect for what you have been dealing with and managing everything else.
The hardest thing was writing and then shooting How to Build a Girl, which is a movie about teenage girls. And, you know, a big teenage girl when my girl was so sad. Like, that was, you know, that's why I tried to put so much optimism in there. And another reason why we made the decision not to make it the focus of the thing what size she was. It was just like, let's just give girls something where there isn't a girl being tortured. She's happy with who she is. If she gets into any pickles or mistakes or dark places, they're her fault and she gets herself back out of them. And give girls something that is good for their souls. Because so many movies about teenage girls and TV shows are about girls who are in a future dystopia and have to save the world, or girls who are going through horrible things, like, you know, being raped at school or going through drug addiction and stuff. And I was just like, show me a happy girl. Like, kind of, our kids need to see one happy teenage girl.
It was so uplifting because of that. It was so uplifting. And, you know, being a mum myself, I know that there's like a knee-jerk reaction to blame yourself for every bit of pain that your child experiences. Did you blame yourself and wish you'd done things differently and all of that?
Yeah, no, of course you do, because you're just going, you know, and I couldn't understand it. I was like, you know, I'm a body positive feminist. I've always taught them to, you know, to love their bodies and sort of, you know, understand sort of why they eat and why they exercise and stuff. And like, how could this have happened? And that's part of the journey that you go on with an eating disorder is learning about this and finally getting your head around it. So if anybody out there is, you know, suspects that their child is ill or is dealing with this, then get in contact with the charity BEAT. They are amazing eating disorder charity. They will give you incredible advice. You will need to get help from the NHS. The good news is that they are the best people in the world. You couldn't go private and get better treatment. They are the world-beating people. The bad news is that because it is chronically underfunded and still not a priority, you will probably have to wait 6 months, a year and a half to get the help you need, which is cognitive behavioural therapy and probably some kind of medication and a dietitian. Once you get that help, the progress can be amazing. In the meantime, all you'll have to rest on, there's an amazing book by a writer called Eva Musby, and she's a mother whose daughter has had several eating disorders. And she incredibly writes scripts of what you need to say to your child to comfort them and make them eat. Because every instinct you have as a parent to make a child do something will not work. You can't punish this kid. It's in hell. You can't treat this kid because it's not interested in anything. It's living through a sort of negation of life. It's punishing itself. You can't, you know, there's no carrot and stick. There's nothing you can do. You can't parent your way out of it. You have to become a medical health professional. And that will not come naturally to you. It will be contrary to many things that you'd want to do as a parent. And she literally gives you scripts. And the first time I read aloud from one of these scripts, the transformation was insane. Like, within 2 minutes, she just went from sort of hoodie up and really sad to just sitting down at the table and going, I will eat. Like, they are miraculous books. They really are.
Wow. That is an excellent recommendation. Okay, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And also to Beat. So one of the things that you talked about when you were talking about this in the book that I thought was really interesting was you kind of brought in how you think maybe for young women today, the prospect of being a grown-up woman is really unappealing, to say the least.
But we don't sell the idea of being a grown-up woman. If you look at every single woman in the world who's like, good and talented and, who we've gone through a phase of loving and going, well, this is the new hero. We love Taylor Swift. We love Beyonce. We love Michelle Obama. All these women. At some point, there's been a ferocious backlash against them for like wearing the wrong thing, saying the wrong thing, getting too fat, getting too thin, going out with the wrong person. So if you were a young girl and you're going, even if I was absolutely the best in the world at my game and beautiful and fit and talented and kind, so many people are going to hate me and try and destroy me. And women are still destroyed. Public women are still destroyed in a way that you don't get for men. So if you were young and you're looking at like, even if you succeed against all the odds and do this incredible stuff and you're sort of giving wonderful things to the world, you're still going to get smashed. A lot of women would just get little girls go, well, why would I want to grow up? And that was another reason why I wanted to write More Than a Woman. Like, I write about how difficult it is as a middle-aged woman in as amusing way as I can. But it ends really cheerfully and positively going, as you move into your older age, and I call it going hag or going crone. I want to reclaim those, reclaim the stage of hag. It's brilliant being a hag. You've got your garden, you've got your dog, you give no fucks, even though you've lost, you lose skin elasticity, but you also lose the amount of fucks that you give. You sit with your other witches and crones and hags cackling all night long. You feel like you know your shit, like kind of, you feel that you are a grown ass woman, and it is amazing. So I'm selling the idea of getting older to younger people. That's my intent.
Moment number six is watching your dog jump into a lake for the sheer joy of it, copying her, and then realizing we all need to be more like dogs.
Yes, so this was huge. So I think so many women, the voice in their head and when they're talking to themselves is unkind and cruel, and we say things to ourselves constantly in our heads that we would never say to a friend. Or the big revelation for me when we got a dog, I am so lovely to my dog. I would just listen to the way that I would talk about, even though it's very stupid and not that beautiful, I would just be going, you're so clever, you're so brilliant, you're so beautiful. And I was like, I've never said that to me. That's crazy. And just seeing the way that dogs live their life, like they're just holly in the moment. They're really happy. They're always pleased to meet people. They love going out. Like, they don't need anything other than just like to sniff and to run and to eat. And I was like, this is a good life this dog has. And when we took her for a walk, she would jump into the lake. And I suddenly just felt so jealous of this dog for a minute. I was like, she looks so happy just swimming in this lake. And then I was like, well, you can jump in the lake. Like, just why not? Like, kind of, So just, we were out in the middle of the countryside and, I just took my clothes off and just went in my pants and bra. It was incredibly cold and painful for 30 seconds. I mean, so cold. I had to do a wee to warm my legs up. I was like, I'm going to treat myself to a little warm waz here. And then suddenly, if you go cold water swimming, after a minute, you suddenly get incredibly high and you feel really warm and serene and kind of like, like you're on morphine or heroin or something. You are off your face. And I was like, and sort of like there's little ducklings next to me and there's a kingfisher whizzing by. And it's like, this is perfect. This has cost me nothing. And this is so joyful. And all I did was just copy my dog. Dogs know what they're doing, man. We need to be more like dogs.
A question about happiness for you. This is my final question to you before I let you go, because I know it's a busy, busy day, is thinking about moments in your life when you have to think of like a purely happy moment, like one that helps you get to sleep, or if you just have to find your happy place, what is that moment?
Oh, that's a good one, because I've got so many. I mean, my happy place is Wales, so I often just walk around the hills in my head. I do this thing at the moment where I'm talking to my future self all the time. I think it's a really useful exercise to do. I go, 60-year-old me, where are you and what are you doing and are you happy? And 60-year-old me will then start talking back to me, and she's very firmly assured me that we live in Wales, that we've got like a farm that we've rewilded, it's stuffed with nature, and I'm walking up a hill in some really great Gore-Tex all-weather gear with a sheep across my back that I've rescued from a hole that it fell down. And I am strong and I am confident, and I maybe even have my own forge where I'm making metal tools, and I'm very good at pottery, and I'm just kind of completely self-sufficient. So that's what that's where I go when I want to be happy. I'm thinking about me when I'm 60 and just planning the house, planning the garden. I've designed so many gardens in my head. So yeah, my little Garden of Eden in my head. That's my plan.
Lovely. And if you have to think about a moment that's actually happened, like a memory.
There was a particularly good Glastonbury 2010. I was so ecstatically happy for 5 days. And then I think at the very end of it, I was just with all my friends. It was perfect. And then Belle and Sebastian came on and played The Boy with the Arab Strap. And I cried so hysterically. My friends were trying to take a lineup picture, like, here we are having a great time. And they didn't realise I was crying hysterically. So when they put the photographs up on Facebook, sort of like 2 days later, everyone else is in a line kind of going, way, party, this is great. And then I'm in the middle looking like my entire family has died in a plane crash. I am hysterical with sadness because it was the happiest I'd ever been. And and I couldn't believe that it was coming to an end. So yeah, Glastonbury 2010, that'll do me.
Nice. And also, you know, a little blast from the past, you know, when we used to go to gigs and things like that.
I know, right? Remember when we used to leave the house and have fun? Yeah. What a crazy dream that is.
In the ye olde days. Well, Catamaran, thank you so much.
This has been so much fun.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Good luck. Good luck with the book. I know it's already 7th.
Yeah, number 7. Yeah, very pleased about that.
I've pre-ordered a copy, even though I got sent a PDF. I want to have a real copy because it was so good.
Oh, dude, thank you.
Okay, and you're welcome.
I'd probably be at number 8 if you hadn't bought that, which means that a pinch of nom would be ahead of me and I'd be really angry. So thank you for helping me crush a pinch of nom.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. This podcast was edited by Lauren Lind and it was all brought to you by The Female Lead. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com or our Instagram or our Twitter or Facebook or TikTok or LinkedIn, you name it, we're there for you. See you next time.